All right. Well, we'll do the formal introductions as they come up. But I am Joel Vessels. I'm the chair of this panel. I'm going to beg everyone's forgiveness for subjecting you to my self-taught and badly neglected French. So if you'll bear with me, we'll see if we can all get through it together. But our panel is titled "The Colonial Empire in All States, Reshaping the Civilizing Mission in Comic Books, Graphic Novels, and Textbooks." I am the chair. I'm Joel Vessels. Do we need to...
So Dr. Vessels is an associate professor of history at Nassau Community College, SUNY, where he teaches modern history, genocide, sports, and the historical politics of popular culture and art. He's appeared on Al Jazeera America discussing the Charlie Hebdo tragedy, and his current work on popular culture and international relations can be found in brief at eInternational Relations, the leading open access internet resource for international relations and geopolitics scholars. His 2010 book, Drawing France, French Comics, and the Republic, is an investigation of the political history of bande dessinée, nationalism, and cultural citizenship in modern France.
Well, the paper I have today is actually both a bit of an outgrowth of that first book and something that occurred as I was finishing the book and putting it into press in 2009. The title of my paper is Tarzan in France, From Rejection to Revelation, First a Corrupter of Youth, Now a Way Towards Living Poetically. May we, these words, coyly bemused, but yes, or of course, offered by Tarzan of the Apes to his first human tutor, the French Lieutenant Paul Darnot, were also among the first that his creator, Edgar Rice Burroughs, had the famed ape man utter. French was not only the lost Lord Greystoke's first spoken human language, he was also often at home in the French hexagon, even as he marveled at the sights of Paris or morosely sipped absinthe and smoked cigarettes as purposefully as any native existentialist. Nonetheless, there remains a sense in which the history of Tarzan, the cultural phenomena, in France is echoed by the reactions to Tarzan the character by the European and American men and women who come in contact with him in serialized novels. First, there's fear and excitement, perhaps a bit of revulsion at Tarzan's literally naked animalistic power. Second, wry if still bemused acceptance by at least some who recognize something uncommon and special about the humanity of the ape man. And finally, a universal embrace of the man as better than the rest of us, with much to teach if only we would stop and learn. And more, the argument here is that the relationship of Tarzan with the land of his first human tongue mirrors not only the trek of Bede in the country, from second-rate corrupter to the ninth art, but the global political fortunes, situation, and desired post of the nation itself as France wrestles with the legacies of empire and national identity in a post-colonial world. Tarzan appeared in illustrated form in France as early as 1931, this is an example of that, in a collection of the first of the great Tarzan artist Harold Foster's serialized newspaper strips of the illustrated Tarzan of the Apes. By 1936, the character had become a regular feature of the popular children's journal Junior, one of the first examples of a children's weekly from a traditional French publishing house to match the size and colored, highly stylized appearance of the largely American-derived and incredibly popular journal, Journal de Mickey, and its companion journal, Robinson. And thanks in part almost to the immediate popularity of the Ape Man, of Tarzan, Junior was one of the few journals to rival the dominance of JDM among French youngsters, with a weekly circulation of over 200,000 issues sold. World War II in Vichy brought a brusque and even violent close to this early history of the children's press and Bédés in France. The end of the war and liberation witnessed a hurried and harried reemergence of the illustrated press, but one that was complicated by certain forces. For many, the still fairly new medium of Bédés had been a corrupting agent on the nation's youth in the years prior to the war, And with the prevalence of pronatalist discourse influencing nearly all social policy in the rebuilding nation, they became an easy target for reformers whose aim was on the protecting the youth of France. When coupled with economics and industry-influenced politics of anti-Americanism, that made Bédés an easy target for reformers and made for a difficult environment where American-derived Bédés often had trouble regaining their pre-war purchase. Even the industry leader, the JDM, General de Mecque, did not return to print until mid-1952, and then it was so altered that it was arguably a French production rather than a licensed import. The fate of our hero, Tarzan, however, was a bit different and much more winding. Unlike a number of other American Bédé-derived Bédés, Tarzan made his triumphal return to France's Bédé Press in 1946 in his own journal. In fact, while some have suggested that this immediate post-war period ushered in a golden age of French Bédé, by the end of the 1940s, Tarzan, the journal, was outselling even the fabled Tintin 4-1. Tintin had about 75,000 copies a week, Tarzan had about 350,000 copies a week. Nonetheless, at precisely this moment, the National Assembly was fiercely debating the issue of Bédés in session after session with an uncommon level of agreement across the political spectrum over the potential dangers of the medium on the nation's children. The only disagreement amongst most in government was not with the notion that something should be done, but over precisely what could be managed. Nearly 3 years of debate finally resulted in what has been called the lamentable 16 July 1949 law, intended to corral and direct, if not limit and control, publications aimed at children. At least one commentator on the law has suggested that, lacking any real censorial teeth, it was generally honored more in the breach than not, with little real effect on the industry in France. More frequently, at least among French scholars of Bédés, estimators of the law have generally followed the analysis of historian Pascal Auré, who argued that it was part of a larger Cold War struggle of France and a crucial part of the nation's attempt at de-Americanization. The law itself, Auré called, a beautiful example of how Western societies came together in the Cold War in an atmosphere of unanimous moralism representative of the Cold War era. The case of L'Affaire Tarzan might suggest that it was more than just that. However, it was not merely a matter of the law being honored in the breach, and it was certainly about more than simply de-Americanization. Even before the law had been passed, Tarzan became a target of reformers, both in and out of the government. In 1950, in the first meetings of the Oversight Commission that was created as a result of the 16 July law, criticism of the journal pointed out almost that Tarzan was almost the worst of a bad lot that was particularly dangerous because of its broad diffusion, and it was allotted the spot of number one enemy, concerned as it was seen to be the pilot journal of the bad children's press. Devoted to the exaltation of the extraordinary physical qualities of a Superman, this illustré is a prototype which more or less directly influences other publications for children. Much of this was a crystallization of attacks on Tarzan, both the character and the journal, across the popular and professional press, and that of the critiques of the government as well, where Tarzan had been decried as a public danger, a national catastrophe, and simply evil. The comic was actually blamed for the 1947 killing of a 5-year-old boy by a 12-year-old boy after a stack of Tarzan comics had been found in his home. Tarzan was even denounced publicly for causing broken bones, for inspiring children to swing Tarzan style from tree branch to tree branch. That Tarzan was to be the chief example of what the commission would warn publishers against valorizing in the pages of their own journals was made clear again in 1950 with its list of 23 general considerations for the Presse Enfantine. Point 7 cautioned against a reliance on these sorts of characters, the anatomy of which is in concert with their psyches. They are microcephaliac Hercules. Very often their cranial capacity with respect to the size of the body is of a proportion much smaller than the average characteristics of the human race. The bestiality of the type continues in multiple detail. Such supermen, or man-monkey, after each triumph over an adversary, launches an inarticulate cry of victory which can come only from purely animal instinct. It is necessary to banish this kind of character by remembering that the young reader is made to identify with the heroes of his reading and move to copy their attitudes. The Presse Enfantin in France cannot make its ideal the apotheosis of physical force and animality. For all the talk of the 16 July law then being aimed at limiting the impact of an amorphous Americanization, what damned Tarzan was not simply its success and possible American provenance, but the fact that he was not sufficiently reasonable or demonstrably intelligent enough to teach anything other than violence. Let Tarzan solve a problem of differential calculus, one critic charged, or ask him to analyze a page of Paul Valéry. In short, his reliance on violence to solve problems that were already made easier marked him, for critics, not only as savage, but simply not truly French. And in the wake of the continuing storm of popular criticism and pressure from the journal was facing from the Oversight Commission, the publishers of Tarzan ended the eight-man's run in the spring of 1952. In the last issue of that journal, the editors spoke directly to their readers in an editorial titled Adieu to Tarzan. Here they defended the character by insisting that we will always consider Tarzan to be an honest, loyal, courageous, just, and irreproachable man. And with that, the bad day of the famed ape-man left behind the civilized world of France's Journal Illustré, just as Lord Greystoke abandoned a world not ready for him in the Burroughs novels. With Tarzan excised from the French Illustrated Press, the Oversight Commission's focus centered on developing standards of maintaining general social mores and the crafting of a media that helped the youth of France deal with the rapid changes of modernization wrought by the 30 glorious years. Something that was not without its own colonial and post-colonial concerns, as Kristen Ross argued in her book, Fast Cars and Clean Bodies, if Algeria is becoming an independent nation, then France must become a modern nation. Some distinction between the two must still prevail. And just as the idea of France as a colonial power receded through the 1960s and into the 1970s, so too did the Illustrated Press come to concern itself more with the issues of modernization and urban lifestyles. Tarzan and his kind were relegated to the space of an earlier time, if not entirely forgotten. Let's skip that. This remained largely the case until the vital ape-man was dusted off and made the center of a multimedia exhibit at the Musée de Quiberonlé, MQB, from mid-June to the end of September 2009. Tarzan held sway in a fantastically imaginative exhibit titled Tarzan or Rousseau Among the Waziri that mixed media and imagery from across the arts and entertainment and political scales and was meant to have, in the words of Museum President Stéphane Martin, the adventures of Lord Greystoke be a starting point for exploring the image we hold in our minds of a particular place. Even more, the earlier concerns about Tarzan's naked animalism and propensity for violence were here brushed away so completely that one might never even realize that such had ever been an issue. Instead, we're told that the myth of the ape-man was the perfect vehicle for examining Western conceptions of Africa because he is the archetypal popular hero. Tarzan embodies the freedom-loving fighter for justice, Martin says, wrote, always righting wrongs and clashing with the lies of civilization. But also because of his popularity, Tarzan's Africa is the vision a lot of Westerners had of Africa in the first part of the 20th century. The exhibit offered, however, intended to extend beyond the last century's first decades and hoped to address what the then deputy director of the MQB, Pierre Hanoteau, lamented remains the case today. We know Africa very badly. This exhibition helps us rethink our view of the continent, but we still don't have a real image of Africa. The exhibit itself gave full breath to the hodgepodge of familiar tropes and totems and unfamiliar tropics as Tarzan came back to life in all the fullness of his different metamorphoses under the mischievous eye of anthropologist and exhibit curator Roger Boulet, Martin insisted. It traces the preconceived ideas and seeks out the clichés by revisiting the history of this larger-than-life character and by playing on the different views people have held in relation to him, epic, neo-romantic, comical. Whether the continent we still know very badly was as well served by Boulet's installation is perhaps a different question, as the museum anthropologist confessed that when presented with the task of developing the exhibit, he confessed that because Tarzan undeniably belongs to the world of childhood, I tried to delve deeper into my childhood memories of Africa and wild men. Boulier's exhibit, according to most accounts, certainly gave full flight to nearly all that he was able to dredge up from that mental cellar of his youth. It was variously described in the international press as being an exhilarating, if giddying, show to a semiotic jungle that was a mess, truth be told, and most everything in between. I'll skip a bunch of this stuff, but the exhibit actually walked you through several broken but connected installations, which was itself a weird hodgepodge. This is actually a prop from Peter Jackson's King Kong film that was on loan to the museum that was just simply stuck in the middle of the whole exhibit, just because. They, in another room, there was a stuffed crocodile, which Boulez said summed up all the dark fears of Africa for Westerners. So it was just this odd and random hodgepodge of things. For most, the best part of the exhibit was actually, if you can make this out, behind Kong here is actually a jumbo-sized selection of panels from Bern Hogarth's artwork of Tarzan. Bern Hogarth is actually one of the very first cartoon artists in France. They gave the title of a ninth artist to. He is widely credited as being the pioneer for the fluid dynamism of comic art today, and he took over the artwork from Harold Forrester for Tarzan. And you see his influence even today in modern comics. He was actually feted at the first Angoulême Festival in 1974 as well. All right. We'll sort of skip all this for now for time. All right. Oh, goodness. But to return to Pierre Horry, who was brought in to the panel exhibit, I think only to make some mention of the 16 July law, Horry simply brushed aside the emphasis of the 16 July law on Tarzan and said it was just merely a matter of the fact that neither Burroughs nor Foster nor even the great Hogarth, whose work is here, was able to resist the dominant moral constraint of their milieu, the grand obsession of all Puritans, sexuality. And after he had dealt with that left-handedly, he then turned to Tarzan and his popularity striding across genre and mediums, having entered into the public consciousness as a totem of many things. Tarzan is indeed a universal and archetypal hero on par with any other, Horry insisted. Oedipus, Faust, Don Juan, Dracula, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, or even Harry Potter. This glossing over of things, as well as the appropriation of the French of Tarzan for the French by way of expertise, is however not entirely unexpected. In fact, it is the same issue and charge that has been made more generally against the museum that will one day bear former President Jacques Chirac's name. It's likely unnecessary here to delve in any real detail into the controversies that have surrounded the MQB since even before its opening, when the popular press was given the opportunity to open its own gaping maw of broadly confused disapproval. Leave it here to say that much of the ink spilled in any quarter, the Academy, popular press, or otherwise, has been broadly condemnatory of what has been frequently excoriated as the museum and the architect of the museum, Nouvelle, Conradian heart of darkness overtones, and that for many it has been an almost hyperreal example of what Herman Leibovitz has cautioned is most often the result of the French tendency to create archives, centers of study, and most importantly, museums. Unfortunately, for all the work, sometimes the best of intentions that generally goes into these projects, Leibovitz argues that by creating institutionalized and static sites, the end result is that it simply updates the old we and the other of the colonial era. Perhaps not coincidentally, writing in his rather up-and-down review of the MQB for the London Review of Books in 2007, Jeremy Harding suggested that the, among other things that should be done to make an interesting idea, an arresting one, was that the silly leather partition should go and the Tarzan decor should be washed off the windows. This was 2 years before the Tarzan exhibit. I don't know if they drew their inspiration from that or not. The graver concerns raised about the museum reach well beyond the Conradian landscape, both in and outside the museum space, and rather address themselves to the issue of how the pieces in the MQB's permanent collection are displayed. Again, to be succinct, the decision made by the museum's directing staff was to focus on an aesthetic rather than a more contextualizing, historically bound, ethnographic approach to the materials being exhibited. And it has been this decision which lay at the heart of the most sincere and critical critiques of the NQB. None of this seems to go away, however. And in fact, with the Tarzan exhibit, Boulay at least seemed intent on actually doubling down not only on the lack of context and kitsch, but on the associational qualities apparently in the museum's plan and execution. "There's nothing more thrown together," he wrote, "than the encounter between Tarzan and Vikings, survivors from the Crusades or the black descendants of Roman soldiers who got lost in Central Africa. With Tarzan, and by extension with any exhibition dealing with our great myths, I think there was room to drive the point home and link together a whole chain of associations which could be laid out in a vast warehouse, like in the savage mind within which the author puts the myth together. Myth through its author comes under the category of intellectual DIY. The problem with that, however, is the people behind the artifacts on display at the MQB are not myths, nor even magical. And again, the question becomes why? So, since I'm running out of time, to conclude this associational mess that I have, I'd like to suggest an answer. I tend to agree with the American historian and museologist Steve Kahn, who insists that even in the 21st century, museums remain as principal places of where knowledge is given shape. We might consider the MQB and its current structure, layout, and aesthetics-driven modus operandi, as a part of a political strategy of the French nation to remain both powerful and relevant in a world that is not simply post-colonial, but globalized as well. If the derogation of context removes the history of the objects on display, and thereby the peoples who crafted them, and even the means by which they were acquired, then it also renders the extreme historicity of the concepts of the universal and universality as things not needing to be queried. Bereft of history to maintain or embed value, only expertise remains and matters. And since no history remains to provide an explanatory narrative, even the manner by which expertise was arrived at is at least occluded, if not made entirely moot. It then becomes simply a matter of passing expert judgment. Or as the historian and former dean of the Inspectorate General of National Education, Dominic Bourne, has said, "How did objects which were not considered works of art by their creators become works of art? It is because art dealers buy them. It's as simple as that. One does not just declare that a work is a work of art. When it has a price in the market, the dealers buy it and the museums put it in museums." Aside from the fact that one might be rightly struck by the market economy ethos on display here, it does press home the idea that it is a community of specialized experts who establish the value of this thing or that. And ultimately, by being the determiners of value, they, this amorphous community of experts, also determine both ownership and access to said objects. For instance, the MQB has suggested that it will mount traveling exhibitions so that indigenous communities have an opportunity to see their cultural heritage. They've even gone so far as to consider what they called restitution in situ, where they would invite a couple of shamans to come and perform a ritual, manipulate and smoke in their sacred pipes that they continued to hold. In many ways, this is a continuation of de Gaulle's middle way to authority, privilege, and power on the international stage. Rather than enter into the scrums of military or economic dominance that France, post-World War II, had no hope of winning, its avenue to international political potency was to be that of the expenditure of cultural capital. However, in a post-colonial world that remains nonetheless neo-colonial by way of economic globalization, the French nation has been forced to once again shift, or sharpen perhaps, the terms in which it operates. The economy-driven Jamesian cash value dominant nature of most international relationships is here mediated by a notion of expertise in the realm of aesthetics. And by way of that, the French are allowed to continue the demand that they are, as historian Madras Eckstein once suggested, the cultural arbiters of the world. I'll end with a word from Turkish novelist and Nobel Prize winner Orhan Pamuk, who wrote in the Museum of Innocence that anyone remotely interested in the politics of civilization will be aware that museums are the repositories of those things from which Western civilization derives its wealth of knowledge, allowing it to rule the world. and likewise when the true collector, on whose efforts the museum depend, gathers together his first objects, he almost never asks himself what will be the fate of his hoard. Thank you.